welcome back, everybody. It is another Thursday. Today is Thursday, the 10th of April, and it is time for another Access to Access presentation. Today, we have a real treat. Our guest is the one and only Chris Martinson, who many of you are familiar with, Chris, and if you're not, you soon will be. He's a prolific writer, runs a great site called peakprosperity.com, and really very much appreciate all that he adds to our community and is frankly one of the smartest guys I know. Chris is he's got a PhD from Duke in neurotoxicology. Then he also has an MBA in finance from Cornell. He is, technically we'll call him an economic researcher and futurist, specializing in energy and resource depletion. And he's the co-founder of that site I mentioned, peakprosperity.com. Chris, thank you so much for spending some time here in Turnville.
Well, Craig, it's a real pleasure to be here on Access to Access, and let's have a good time.
Let's do it. I just am very, very appreciative of you coming in and helping us out, because there's just so much going on in the world, and I really value your expertise in being able to look over the horizon. I mean, there are not enough folks out there that can take it all in and really project forward as to where we're going. And I that's what I think you do, and that's what I think makes Peak Prosperity so valuable. I guess as we dive right in, this year, everybody felt like 2014 was going to be a year of consequence, and so far through the first quarter, I don't think anybody's been disappointed in that regard. There's a lot to be worried about out there. Just frankly, as you look at it all, as we stand here on the 10th of April, what concerns you the most, Chris?
Well, you know, the thing I find most concerning is that we didn't learn any lessons from 2008, which was actually a reflection of the fact that we didn't learn any lessons from 2000 and 2001, which was a reflection of the fact we didn't learn anything in 1998, which meant we didn't learn anything in 1994. It all started with Greenspan. I mean, we are so far into this rabbit hole, it's really hard to know at this point, you know, which pin we want to point out that the bubble is in search of. But let's just add it up. You know, the macro perspective is really important here. We've had 40 years of borrowing faster than our incomes have been rising across the entire OECD continuum, right? That's Japan, Europe, and the United States. Well, nobody can borrow twice the rate of their income forever. That sort of came to a head in 2008, and you know what we did is we doubled down. By we, I mean the Fed et al. And all their proxy agents. You know, it's all the governments, right? Off we go. So I'm really concerned that, you know, we see this geopolitical tension with Russia and China, obviously in their own best interest, starting to maneuver away from the United States and Western Europe for good reasons. We see Japan, their Abenomics experiment failing like crazy, and that could be a place that triggers the avalanche finally. I don't know which really to point at this point in time, except to say that I note the risks, right? Risks didn't change. In fact, they got worse. You know, is sovereign debt higher or lower than in 2008? Do we have more or fewer derivatives than in 2008? You know, are the banks too big to fail, or are they, you know, smaller than they were in 2008? I mean, every single thing I track, Craig, just says the risks are getting larger and larger, and it's a complex system. Nobody can predict when a complex system is going to shift, but we can look at the risks, right? You know, 20 feet of snow on a cornice is worse than 10 feet.
No, that's an excellent point. Chris, is one of the things that we often talk about here in Turdville is the eventuality of a shift in the global monetary system. You know, that Zero Hedge likes to post that chart all the time of the lifespans of reserve currencies. And I think it's human nature to just assume that what you've always known is the way things will always be. You know, there's really no living citizen left. Well, maybe other sides than a handful of octogenarians who remember when the U.S. dollar was not the reserve currency of the world. And so it's very hard for people to then picture a world where it isn't. I see that as an eventuality. Do you? And if so, what do you think could be the next global system?
Well, on the first point, it's an absolute inevitability. that the international currency system is going to collapse at some point. And it has to. And there's, you know, whether they're supposed to last for 40 or 50 years max or not, I don't look at that as really the thing that guides me. I might go all the way back to the Bible, the Quran, and the Torah, all of which expressly forbid the use of interest-based money. And in the Bible, they talk about having a jubilee, which is seven periods of seven, seven times seven, 49. After 49 years, they knew that after you go through 49 years of compounding interest, your system just blows up. So you might as well just reset and off you go. So on that basis, we might say this all started August 15th, 1971,
yep.
Seven periods of seven, 49. That brings us to the year 2020. That sounds about right. You know, and it's just a math problem. That's all it is when you look at the number of claims that money represent that are out there, all the charts of money are exponential. And then you look at debt, all of those charts are exponentially growing. Listen, as long as we're in a world that's infinite, there's nothing wrong with having exponential money in debt. But when you get to the point where we are in the story right now, where we cannot increase oil exponentially anymore, it's costing us five times as much today to get as much out of the ground as we did 6 years ago. That's just the nature of the game, right? So we're at this really awkward part of human history where we're kind of running into some certain resource limits, whether it's aquifers or, you know, under Saudi Arabia, which are due to run out in 2016 or in the southwest of the United States even, or maybe even in parts of Kansas on the western edge there.
Yeah.
So when we look at where we are in this story, first from a resource standpoint and then from a monetary standpoint, there's just this big collision that I think has already started. I think that's what people are feeling when we see Greece going down the well shaft, or we're looking at what's happening in the Ukraine, or what just happened with these so-called Arab Springs, which weren't about democracy. These were people being hungry in Egypt and Syria and other places. This is all saying, hey, we're alive at a really, really interesting moment in history. We have a money system that doesn't know how to do anything but expand, and a bunch of defenders of that particular status quo. And we've got some really interesting stories on the resource side, and this is all kind of going to come to a head. And I truly believe it's happening in the 20 teens.
Yeah. I would imagine you sound a little bit like Jim Quinn too. Have you read the Fourth Turning, and ascribe to that philosophy, if you will?
Well, yeah, I do believe there are these longer periods, and I hate the part of saying this time is different, but the truth is we've never had a planet with 7.2 billion people on it before. We've never had a situation where in the next 20 years, if trends hold, we are going to go from 1 billion people in the middle class to 3 billion people in the middle class, courtesy of India and China mainly. That's just such an extraordinary, almost instantaneous demand on the resources of this world, which are showing real serious signs of being depleted, if not, in some cases, we can say exhausted at some point. Like, you know, bluefin tuna stocks exhausted, aquifers exhausted, conventional oil way past peak. You know, these are all things that are true. It's just such a big, hard story to get your head around. Very few people can really focus on it and then understand what it really implies.
Well, and that's, again, I think the advantage of what you do at Peak Prosperity, in that you come at this, or come at a lot of your research and what you write from the perspective of a scientist, right? And that you try to find verifiable data and try to take that to its logical conclusion. I mean, is that a good way to kind of summarize how you do what you do?
Yeah, it's just data. They're facts. They might be inconvenient facts, but, you know, we add them all up. And they clearly come to some sort of a conclusion, if you will, that seems inescapable. And here's the great thing, Craig. When I show people the crash course or they read the book, the 99 times out of 100, the most consistent piece of feedback I get is somebody saying, you know what, you didn't tell me something I didn't already know. It's just you put it all in one spot. People already have that uncomfortable feeling,
yep,
intuitively or intellectually, that something in our narrative is kind of off the rails. And, you know, you just have to open up a paper and say, hey, where are the honeybees? That doesn't feel good to me, you know. Where's the megafauna in Africa? That doesn't feel right, you know, or whatever, you know, whatever your flashpoints are. Or maybe it's the fact that the Fed's performing its magic rain dances and you know, showering the world with money, but the economy for some reason isn't responding. You know, however you look at it, you can say, something's not working. And that's what we try to do, is provide that framework for saying, well, here's a way you could look at it where the things that we're reading kind of all make sense.
And let's—I'm going to use that as a segue. Let's talk about Crash Course for a second, because that's a series that. When did you first record that? I mean, that's been a little while, hasn't it?
Yeah, it started recording in February of 2008. I finished the final chapter in October 2008, 2 weeks before everything sort of kicked out and let loose. And it's the whole thing is being redone behind the scenes right now. We're about 5 months into that project, so it's all getting updated now.
Wow. And when will that be done, Chris?
I'm hoping in a month or two at the most.
There's something to look forward to. And if people want to see the original, they can go to peakprosperity.com and find it there?
They can. It's in 12 languages, too. Some of them fully transcribed, meaning both the text and the audio have been fully done in several languages. All the biggies, Spanish, French, German.
Dynamite. I didn't know that. That's very cool. Well, let's segue right into then some questions. I've got three of them that were emailed to me from subscribers. And for everybody listening, if you've been a part of A to A before, you know the drill. Look in your go to webinar control panel, find the drop down tab for questions, and in that dialog box, type in your question. And I will lay it out for Chris and get his answer. Let me start, as those questions pile up, let me start with one of these email questions. This one comes from Marco, who notes that in your 3-hour crash course, or how many hours there are, which he says was his wake-up call, and he thanks you for that, you have provided the community with lots of materials and statistics, etc. You also challenge your audience to step forward if they can diffuse the data or have sound counter-arguments. So Marco wants to know, how many times have you been challenged? And in what areas do people actually challenge you?
I get challenged constantly, but never on the data. So this is Adam, my business partner, and I, we have a moment. We call it the iPhone moment. Like, we'll give a talk. Here's an example. I was giving a talk at Oxford, right, over there in the UK. And it's a very erudite crowd, and it was in their environmental center, and there were a bunch of graduate students in there. And I give my talk, and this graduate student reaches into his back pocket and holds up his iPhone and says, "Great presentation, but I think you've forgotten about these," right? And his point was, technology's going to solve the day, right? And that's what we call, it's an iPhone moment, or is our shorthand, but it's a belief-based argument. It's him saying, "I believe technology is going to find a way." And these people never can sit down and actually have the next layer of substantive part of the conversation, which is like, okay, well, this is how many quadrillion BTUs we currently get from fossil fuels. Here's the flow rates and maximums that we can get out of alternative energy. Why don't you draw a line and tell me how we connect those two dots, because there's a huge gap right now. And there's time involved, there's scale, cost. How are we addressed? And they just stop. You know, they're not interested in engaging
right
in that conversation. So I get challenged on beliefs a lot. People say, "I believe you're being too pessimistic. I don't think the future will turn out like you're saying." And I'm saying, I'm not telling you how it's going to turn out. I'm telling you that these critical materials are depleting at this rate, and we can figure out when they become uneconomical under current terms to exploit. Right. So there's that. I had a run at one point where we had a bunch of people come in from a monetary theorist group, and they really took exception to my identification of our money system as by definition being exponential, and they had a very fancy spreadsheet which showed that if money circulated perfectly, it didn't have to grow exponentially at all, to which I would just sort of wander over and say, "But look at the charts. Here's a chart of money growth, and if we curve fit that, as scientists, we can do curve fit, and we put an exponential curve fit, which means we're trying to match our data to a formula to see how close it is. It matches with 99% precision. We have an exponential money system." But I got in these really useless arguments for a while where people were trying to prove to me that our money system didn't have to be exponential. And I said, well, whether it has to be or not, it is, and that's the way it works. So those are the kinds of challenges I get. They're really picking at the edges. I've never had anybody come up and say, "Oh no, you're totally wrong. You know, here's the data on oil, on copper, on water, on money, on debt." There's never been a substantive challenge like that yet.
Yeah. I would think too on the money people. Do they not understand how fractional reserve banking works? I mean,
that's the thing. They understood a theory of it, which wasn't actually how it comported in reality. And, you know, I had one guy send me this brilliant spreadsheet which showed how he thought it worked. And I just wrote back and I said, "Your problem is you have a 10% reserve ratio built in at the beginning of your model. There's no such thing anymore. Not since Greenspan implemented the sweeps program, which enables ordinary banks to take money out of demand accounts, which do need a reserve balance held against them, sweep them out of those accounts at 11:59 at night, so that at 12 o'clock, when the Federal Reserve takes a snapshot of what needs to be held in reserve, there's magically nothing in those demand accounts, and then they get swept back over again at 12:01. Right? That's how our banking system works. There is no reserve limit. And by the way, that fits with all the data that I could then show somebody about assets versus liabilities versus shadow banking versus, but the data doesn't really matter. What happens is people, this is the hard part about what I learned. I had to learn the hard way that I'm not actually in the business of providing information. I'm in the business of challenging beliefs. And if somebody wants to hold the belief that they will have to make no substantive changes and that the future will be better than the past, there's really nothing I can do to dislodge that with data. It's frustrating because I can say I'm not trying to bum you out. I'm just trying to show you some data, like a doctor would. That would say perhaps it's time for a lifestyle shift. You know, there's some things here you might want to consider, right? And that's the interesting part about this. And I'm sure you run into this all the time when you can tell when people march in with their beliefs because they start out agitated and it goes downhill from there, right? It's an emotional conversation, not a factual conversation.
I would imagine pretty much everybody listening to this feels that way, you know, whether they've sat around the table at Thanksgiving or just talked over a barbecue grill with their neighbor. I mean, it's the same experience. It's that cognitive dissonance or normalcy bias or whatever you want to, you know, whatever it is. But people don't want to have their beliefs challenged in that way. You're absolutely right. Let me move on to the next question. This one comes from Gary. Again, remember what I warned you about A2A, we kind of jump around a little bit. Gary says he invests in physical silver because though he sees it as money, he also knows it's good for industrial uses too. So he wants to know if you think that silver will ever be challenged for its electrical and heat conducting industrial applications by products like graphene. You got an opinion on that one?
I am mainly a holder of silver for its awesome industrial uses. It's always possible that graphene could supplant it in certain cases and applications. The jury's still out on that one for me. Let's review the things that silver is. On the periodic table of elements, it's the most reflective element on there. It's the most conductive. And it has certain antimicrobial and health properties which are virtually unmatched by any other compound on there. So it's got a wide range of uses, and we continue to find more uses for it constantly. It's possible graphene will supplant that in a few places. I'm not convinced of that yet. It takes a long time to really take something and insert it into a manufacturing process at scale. So let's take an example. Let's say tonight somebody discovers that, that 0.1 grams of silver that we use for every watt of solar panels that are currently produced, we found a way to replace that with graphene. It would still take 10 years, I would guess, before you would have half penetration of graphene into that market for a simple reason, right? There's already an industrial process in a plant and billions of dollars of investment in using that silver solder at that certain component. It's usually not that easy to swap out an entirely new substance into a process. So you can build up a whole new plant or completely retool and all of that. But first, the cost of using silver would have to be so high that you would say it's now worth it to, you know, ditch my past capital, retool my processes, bring this new substance in. And by the way, the 0.1 grams per watt is such a tiny component of the actual final retail cost value or wholesale cost value of the solar panels, that, you know, silver would have to go to something really stupid, astronomical in price before I think it would be worth making that shift on that basis alone, or it would have to become so scarce that manufacturers worried about the scarcity issue. I don't see either of those two things happening anytime soon. So on that basis, you know, just looking at where we use silver and how, I love it to death. And in particular, when you look at the mine supply of silver, the ore grades for pure silver mines are just... Listen, we're going to be out of silver in 15 years from known deposits of actual mined silver. Most of it, 75%, comes from base metal mining activities.
Right.
There too, you know, there's some interesting trends there that say I really like silver from a supply and a demand standpoint right now, and cost.
And to your point, it's another reason why there is such an aggressive lobby out there to try to keep silver prices down. Investment demand in silver seems to be one of those things, like anything else, as it goes up in price, it increases the investment demand. Yeah. And that's one component of that supply-demand equation they've got to keep under control is investment demand. Let me just move on. The next question comes from John. John wants to know, I guess it's a two-part question, Chris. When he says, of course, the USA economy collapses because of fiat money failure, will all Western economies suffer the same degree of fate? He's a Canadian resident. That's why he's wondering. And then second part of the question is, Goldman Sachs has made major exits from three different sectors, if you will, in the last 3 days. What do you think all that means? So there's two separate questions from John.
All right. Well, let me start with the second one and remind me if I forget the first one.
Sure.
Goldman Sachs has proven to be savvy for quite a while. You know, this whole HFT thing that just blew up, and so you see Goldman Sachs exiting the HFT business and also thinking of exiting the dark pool business. And we look at what they're really doing. You know, I've been running podcasts with like people like Saluzzi for years, and Zero Edge has been on the HFT thing for 6 years now, probably. So that's been percolating along for a while. I think Goldman Sachs always knew that was a pony that would die on the trail at some point. So they've clearly, I think, you know, been thinking through and maneuvering where they want to be in this particular story for a while. So by the time it's announced at Goldman Sachs, I believe the decisions were already made, you know, years ago.
Sure.
And they've been thinking it through carefully. So there's some stuff going on there. The funny thing about the HFT, you know, it was amazing, first of all, to see people like O'Brien from the president of BATS come on and Minaj, come, this other guy who's out of an HFT outfit, watching them come on and just be so offended at with the implication. But the implication was this, it's rigged, right? It's just a rigged market. And that, of course, touches the central nerve of Wall Street, because the whole thing's just a skimming operation. The whole thing.
Yeah.
Wall Street, that's all they do. So it clearly they had to circle the wagons, and if Goldman Sachs at all have to lop off the diseased limb and call it HFT and say, there, we took care of it, it's no longer rigged, they'll do that in a skinny minute, because they don't want the deeper questions to be asked, which is, wait a minute, you guys are just, you're all skimming, ain't you?
Yeah, you know? Everybody is. Yep.
And so I think that's where that's going. Second question was about, will all Western economies fare equally? And the answer to that is no. There's going to be huge differences. But the backdrop to this is we have to presume that the currencies involved remain intact, right? So like the Japanese yen, I could see that going from 100 to the dollar to 1,000 or more, maybe 5,000. I mean, it's worth less than that. I mean, the amount of claims that the Japanese yen have arrayed against their country are astronomical and need to be debased badly, and they will be at some point. But against what? Maybe the dollar? Okay. But, you know, if the dollar starts to get cracked, right, if somehow this Chinese-Russian axis comes forward and they are powerful enough to break the petrodollar and they start trading in oil and something other than dollars, and other countries begin to migrate towards that market as well as trading in petrodollars, and then the petrodollar collapses, we'll find that the United States has about $7 trillion of outstanding reserve claims. That what are people going to do with those if they don't need them so much anymore? We could see the dollar take a really, really big hit, but there's no reason for the Canadian dollar to have to long-term take a big hit. Let's be clear, the Canadian dollar will do miserably just because of the whole, you know, we sneeze, they catch pneumonia kind of effect.
Right.
They'll have that sort of a moment, but ultimately Canada has got tremendous resources. These are things that the world needs more of, not less of, as we go forward. Those are going to become a higher flashpoint in the future and things that are worth a lot more. So the countries I am most favorably inclined towards long-term are those that have really favorable demographic profiles and populations relative to resources and still have good resources to go with. Few of them are basket cases. You know, on those three fronts, Argentina is a great place. They've just been horribly mismanaged politically for so long. That it's a basket case, but on paper they look great, you know, and Canada too. So this could all get messy for a little while, but the victors in this story are going to be those with access to resources and with a political system that can manage to not go insane in the process.
And I mean, is there really, you mentioned devaluing the yen and that, you know, and at 5,000 to a dollar, and then you think, but then of course a dollar has to probably be devalued as well, so it wouldn't go that far. I mean, and this may be a too long of an answer, I don't know, but I mean, is there a way out other than devaluation? I mean, because they're not just going to just default, I wouldn't think, the U.S. or Japan. I mean, is there any other way that it can be fixed?
Well, the only possible way that I can think of is if they very delicately have the central banks assume all of these dodgy assets. So when I say right now, all of the OECD countries collectively, when you look at debt to GDP, the number is 350%. And that's just debt, right? That doesn't include liabilities, that, you know, which would be mm-hmm. your pension shortfalls, your entitlement program shortfalls, Medicare, right. Medicaid, all that stuff, right? Then you might get to a number more like 500 or 600% collectively. In the United States, it's over 1,000% right now. It's awful. But you just look at the pure debt numbers, those debts are just simply too large, unless you're in a world which can have robust 5% yearly economic growth. If we say, maybe those days are over, because we don't have the cheap oil to support that, we don't have the other cheap resources, there's this debt overhang, what can we do about this? The only logical solution is to get rid of the debt overhang, because it's the only thing you can do something about. And that involves having the central banks buy those debts, put them on their balance sheet, and let them die there, right? As long as all the central banks do that in coordination, by the way, this is what we call the last 4 years of our existence.
Yeah.
As long as all the central banks do that in coordination, I think they can get away with it, because the point is, like, if you're Japan or you're Norway's sovereign wealth fund and you see this dynamic, you're like, wait, they're all printing. Where do you put your money? Like, what do you do? You're Norway. You have a multi-hundred-billion-dollar sovereign wealth fund, and you go, do I shift out of dollars into euros? Wait, if I don't like those, into yen? Where do you go? There's nowhere to go, right? So there's this sort of trapped dynamic that happens as long as all the central banks are holding hands and singing kumbaya. The question we need to focus on is what might cause those banks to break ranks and say, you know what, we don't want to play like this anymore. And that was to me the larger subtext of the Bundesbank saying we'd like some of our gold back, because it potentially indicated that first fracturing of trust across those institutional entities collectively known as the central banks.
And in the situation you described, I mean, it just takes one to say, yeah, I think I'm going to start heading toward the exit here. And then the others notice that happening. And then all of a sudden there's a kind of could be a stampede.
Correct. But if all the central banks are roughly playing the same game, what we'll notice in that stampede is not that the currencies are going to fall against each other. The USD index might stay pegged at 80. The yen might stay pegged at 100. The euro might be there at $1.30 or, you know, 1.3. Mm-hmm. So, but what we'll see is we'll see the prices for things go insane.
Yeah.
Right? Gold, silver, Stradivarius violins, land, anything that you could possibly get out of those currencies into that represents hard stuff. You'll see those really, really start to spike. And oh, by the way, these are exactly the moves that a lot of wealthy people and institutions have been making years ago. Because this is just simple trend extrapolation. Anybody can think this through and say, wow, this probably ends with currencies being debased, but against what? I don't care. I better own that stuff now.
Yeah,
that's already happened.
Which is shown every day in the Chinese import numbers of gold. That would be one of those categories, I guess, that would reflect that.
Well, absolutely. China's been just sly as a fox in this whole thing, you know, where I don't think China really cares how they get the tonnage into their country. So if you try and do it officially, if the Chinese bank comes out and says, we're buying gold with our $4 trillion in reserves, that'll create quite a stampede. And I'm sure there's been plenty of bat phone conversations between the Fed and the Bank of China, People's Bank of China, where they said, please don't do that. So the People's Bank of China still officially has 1,054 tons on the books. That's a laughable number. They right. probably have at least 300% more than that. But you're China, right? So what you do is you say, well, what if we had just people buying it? 212 tons a month on average are flowing out of the Shanghai Gold Exchange, out of their vaulting system into private hands and into private vaulting systems. That's extraordinary. And if you're a patient people, you can just say, yep, let's do that. A couple hundred tons a month. look, the prices don't really seem to be getting affected. I would be surprised if China doesn't have well north of 10,000 tons inside of its border, and in a couple more years it'll have north of 20,000 tons, which means it'll be one of the largest economic powerhouses anywhere, should, if, when we have this major currency revolt and we get repriced against real things.
Yep. All right, moving on. And again, I want to thank you for being generous with your time. So I want to just kind of dive into just a few more questions we have from the listeners. Hold on, I skipped away from the one I wanted to ask you first. It was kind of right in line. Oh, here we go.
All right.
This one comes from Bill. Bill is the mantra in these last couple of years as paper price has been driven down is to just keep on stacking while you can. Chris, what do you suggest as a, again, this is just off the cuff. I don't, you know, no one's going to looking for investment advice here. This is just an off the cuff question for you. What do you suggest the ratio of precious metals should be to total wealth? And then further, I mean, do you have a ratio between gold and silver? And then assuming that you have physical gold and silver, what type do you own? Bullion, coins, that kind of thing.
All right. Excellent questions. So the answer is going to be long too, ish. The number that's right for everybody for gold is, you know, one view of that is we say, well, this is really complicated. You know, how old are you? How much money do you have? All of that. But actually, I have one number. I have one number that works for everybody, and that is the amount of your money out of the banking system stored in monetary metals that allows you to sleep well at night. I think sleeping well is really overlooked and underrated. It's one of the best things. So I happen to own an amount that allows me to sleep well at night, and I'm really aggressive with it, always have been. I just recalced my numbers. I'm actually at a perfect two-thirds, one-third, two-thirds gold and silver compared to one-third other stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And even in that one-third other stuff, all of that's just sitting in cash and real estate at this point in time. That's my personal split, super aggressive, right? But I'm at a position where I don't have to touch that two-thirds now or ever, right? I don't need that to live on. If I did, I'd be having a very different ratio. But I don't, you know, so that's the amount I can park off and say, let's just have that sit there. And so when we look within that, my gold to silver dollar to dollar ratio is also two-thirds to one-third, gold to silver. Obviously not, you know, on a raw ounce basis. I first started buying gold and silver heavily in 2002. My first purchase of silver was 100 ounce bars at $4.53 an ounce. And I accumulated, you know, as much as I could back then. And so I'm just sort of sitting on that. And if I have to sit on it for another 12 years or 24 years, I don't care. I'm looking for certain ratios to come back to tell me it's time to get back out of those assets into other more productive assets. And so I'm looking at things like ounces of silver to buy a house or an acre of land,
right. Same
ratio for gold, things like that.
Right.
Yeah. So those are the pieces that I'm really looking at and that are guiding me at this point. So it turns out, you know, I've met people for whom even having two gold ounces causes them to lose sleep because they don't like the fact that it goes up or down in price. And I'm like, well, then don't own it. You're not built for it. Because I don't track the daily price of gold in terms of how much of it I have and then convert it into dollars and then ask myself how wealthy I am. I count how many ounces I have. That's my key metric. Now, I get totally, you know, nutty when I watch these silly bear raids happen, you know, like post-Cyprus, right? Watching the price of gold go from 1600 down to 1175 in the months immediately following the announcement that they were going to start seizing the wealthy's bank accounts. I mean, that was like the perfect time for gold to go through the moon, and it does the exact opposite. That drives me nutty. But at the same time, it doesn't bother me from my own personal wealth standpoint. It simply allows me to accumulate more at more favorable prices if I choose. So that's been my approach with it all along. And you know, I think for most people, you know, you just have to decide. This is the only question I'm solving for is what percent of my assets do I want to be absolutely sure will never go to zero because somebody changed a rule or flicked a pen or closed a bank or something, right? And you know, that's it. So gold is literally the only monetary asset that I know of that it's not simultaneously somebody else's liability. And of course, I'm only talking physical. in
right.
your possession.
And how do you prefer your physical, Chris?
Coins, well, gold? The gold I've bought all in highly recognizable 1 ounce or smaller denominations, right? So a lot of American Eagles, things like that.
Yep.
And Krugerrands, because I think those are pretty recognizable. Yep. Silver, I did buy a bunch of junk silver, and way back when. But now I tend to prefer it in the 3.9s category. And the reason for that is I was talking with this guy, Robert Mish, not the Mish who runs Global Economic Blogspot, right, but another one. Robert Mish, who runs he's been running a coin store for 50 years, a bullion shop out in Menlo Park, California. So he was there in 79, early 1980. You know, he talked about what a real bubble looks like when there were lines stretched all the way around the block. And he said this was when there were probably 10 coin gold dealers all within a stone's throw of his place as well. His place was just mobbed, so mobbed that he had to go outside, separate buyers from sellers, have the sellers come in first so he had product, and then bring the buyers in. And sometimes even doing that right on the street, matching them. He said that's a bubble. But he learned something from that, which was that when it really hit and you had all these people, you know, the sellers were coming down with grandma's silver plated stuff or the silverware itself or coins or whatever, that 90% or 0.92% sterling or whatever the grade was, if it wasn't 3.9s, he couldn't take it and ship it out to the refiners because the refiners all got backed up. They're the ones who are going to go and take that, go through the acid process, extract the pure silver, recast it as 3.9, COMEX ready bars or good for delivery for industrial purpose bars. And so when he said what happened when it really got heated up, they had these 11-week wait times because the refinery system was clogged for the 0.92 silver, but the 3.9 stuff, in and out. That was like highly liquid and could enter the system very rapidly. So what happened was people who were trying to sell their less than 3.9 silver discovered that there were these really, really steep markdowns that happened, right? 30%, 40% under spot kind of moments, which was what they had to offer is all they could offer because, A, their capital would get tied up as a shop owner, right? They were like, I might be holding on to this for 11 weeks. So I'm going to give you cash for it now. Here's, I would rather have my cash or capital deployed in more liquid investments because this stuff's moving fast. Plus, I'm going to have to take the risk, like this bubble could burst, and I may be sitting here holding a big pile of stuff that is now worthless by the time I can clear it to the refiner. So on that basis, I'm a big fan now in silver of only holding 3.9 stuff, and I do like silver rounds of varieties of denominations. I'm not as beholden to the idea of needing to hold American Eagles with their larger markup, but I think they're fine too. And then I hold a bunch of 10-ounce bars as well, because I think that's a neat denomination. Mm-hmm. And I have 100-ounce bars, but honestly, by the time, if I'm ever really trading those in, because we're in one of those moments, those are probably going to be big-ticket items. So personally, all I'm buying now when I do accumulate more are 1-ounce rounds in 3.9s.
Fair enough. That's outstanding. Thank you. Just a couple more questions because we've already passed 35 minutes. You kind of addressed this just a moment ago, but Ned wants to know, how Jim Sinclair is running around giving his presentation globally about getting out of the system and even getting certificated shares out of your IRA. How do you feel about that? Is that something that that you talk to people about too?
Well, we do. Adam and I are in the business of helping people find security and safety, and many times there are financial advisors who we think do a better job of really helping people be secure and safe. And one of the things that we did help people do through their financial advisors was actually take receipt of your certificates, which I don't believe is possible anymore. I think the DTCC has said niet to that at this point. So. And the reason for that is that even when you think you own a share and you've got a CUSIP number on it, there's a darn good chance that it's been lent out for shorting and then rehypothecated multiple times so that if we get into sort of like a one of these market downturns that really scares people, I'm not positive that we know that share ownership is going to be so clear cut. I don't think gold ownership is so clear cut. I fully agree. Not just Europe, not just Cyprus, but now New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and the United States have all got either rules implemented or proposed that basically repeat the bail-in formula, right? So that little trial run was so successful. It mystifies me why anybody would keep any amount of cash beyond, simple living in the banking system at this point in time, because they have said, hey, we might shut it down on moment's notice. We won't tell you in advance. And we might decide to come up with some bail-in formulas. And I don't think there's any sort of thought, that people could trust that even if you had, say, right now there's the FDIC limits, 250, but you're going to be cautious and you're going to think maybe they'll dial that back to 100,000. So let me parse my money in $100,000 increments across multiple accounts. I'll be safe. Yeah, they'll change that rule too. They might say 100,000 for any one account. That's what we guarantee. So I have, you're talking to a guy who has zero faith in the banking system at this point, but I'm one of those, like, fool me once, shame on you, but fool me twice. They've said exactly what they're going to do, and they've done it. Like, I'm one of those people that says, if you say you're going to do something and then you do it, you probably did it, and you're going to do it again. This banking system itself is going to do anything it has to do to protect itself,
yep,
including change the rules, take your money. That's as clear as day.
Yep. We've seen that just in the last 5 years, their willingness to do whatever it takes to just kind of keep going as long as they can. One last question, I guess kind of along those lines. We're talking about the banking system and where does it all go from here? A common question in this format is people want to know if, I think from reading your bio, you live in Massachusetts somewhere. Do you have a bug out plan, or do you plan to, if it really gets nasty, just kind of stick it out in the U.S.?
Oh, no, I'm here. This is dyed-in-the-wool patriot. I'm American. Here's where I live. If I was trying to pick a perfect place for safety, I might not pick exactly where I am, but it's fine. And yeah. I did very carefully choose this region of Massachusetts against other places I might live in New England, and it feels reasonably safe and secure to me. You could not force me to live in a place like Midland, Texas, all of its oil wealth, but a really, really fractured Hispanic to white population where they never really talk to each other, zero water, like just horrible resources, and if things get tough, that's when people start to get cranky. You couldn't force me to live in certain parts of Atlanta, Oakland, Northern Jersey, other places, right? Because I think those communities have fault lines in them.
Right.
And they don't have the kind of community cohesion that I think is going to really make some places be totally fine. Like if I was Amish and I lived in Amish country, I'd say, well, I don't think they'll even be affected, by any particular downturn. Mormons might be the same way. So I happen to be, don't come from one of those two tribes, as it were. And so where I live right now, we've got really good community. It's probably my number one asset. And by good community, I mean, I've got a group of people who we are all helping ourselves become more resilient. We've got food production going. We've got multiple types of energy systems in our house, from wood to solar to oil to whatever we're using, but in combination. We talk about these things all the time in terms of what might happen. We're working through issues now with each other while it's easy to do rather than later once it really counts and things are a little more tense potentially. So if I didn't live in a place that had community, I would move to a place with community. And by the way, that's what I did. I left Mystic, Connecticut. Beautiful town. Great place to visit. Tourists go there all the time. No community that we could detect while we lived there. Just sterile. To a place with a fairly rich and deep community. And, that was moving a couple hours up the road. So it varies a lot from place to place. And if I didn't live in a place with good, solid community, even at this stage of life, I'd consider moving.
It's fantastic advice. Chris, before we wrap up with what I call my final four, tell everybody, give your own commercial. Tell everybody about Peak Prosperity and the value of your site and how the service works.
Great. Well, Peak Prosperity is centered around two distinct communities that we have. And so we have kind of two distinct websites there. One community of people are really passionate about understanding the context of where the world's going, that they find utility in being alert and aware of what's happening. They're very curious, and they often use this information to make decisions in their life, whether it's around their portfolio or outfitting their house for greater resiliency or building community or whatever. So that's one community around peak prosperity. And then we have a second site called resilientlife.com, and you can get to it right off of the peak prosperity main page easily. And when you go there, you find these are people who are really starting to burrow into the lifestyle decisions that come up. So we have all kinds of stuff on there about raising chickens and insulating your house and permaculture and all these things that might be your personal response to this shifting set of things that are coming along. And our mission is we're creating a world worth inheriting. You know, that's what we're trying to do here. And the people who join us at Peak Prosperity are care about that. Like we believe that it's our responsibility to get ourselves as resilient as possible, but as soon as we have that squared away, our responsibility now extends outward into the world. And it might go to our neighbors first, might go to our larger community, but ultimately it really is we feel responsible as participants in where this is all headed. And I got to be honest, I personally think we're headed flat out the wrong direction right now. So I'm really trying to, my deeper work is trying to change the narrative in the world. And we have one narrative that says, we're here to use stuff up as fast as we can because that makes good economic sense. I don't think that's right anymore. I think, you know, it's up to us to start to shift that narrative and say, maybe we're not consumers anymore. Maybe that wasn't even worthy of us, you know. What a degrading moniker that is. Maybe we should consider ourselves stewards rather than consumers. How does that shift the story, right? And that's what I think we have to be. You know, I'm absolutely appalled that we are ripping the oil and gas out of the ground in the Bakken so fast that we don't know what else to do with the oil, with the gas except to flare it. You know, we're just burning it.
Yeah.
And it's such a critical resource, and we've decided as a culture that our job is to take it out of the ground so fast we don't know what else to do besides burn it into the open air. It's like, we need to change that because that's not right, you know. So that's what we're trying to do is change the story, but not from doom and gloom standpoint. It's really saying, this is fun, engaging, interesting work. In fact, we want to find those things that really challenge us to step into what we think are more fulfilling, more authentic expressions of ourselves. And I don't buy into my country story, which is my highest use is a consumer, right? That's a stuffed goose in a feedlot, you know? I don't see myself that way. So I think that's what we're doing at Peak Prosperity is peeling the covers off with a bunch of curious, engaged people and seeing how we can make the best out of what looks to be an increasingly interesting run.
One word, right? I can't even spit it out. Peakprosperity.com. And everybody can plainly see right here on this podcast page a link to the site. And if you haven't ever been there, I encourage you to check it out. No question about it. All right, Chris, the last thing we do here, I call it the final four. This is just four quick questions. Just you can often answer them with just one or two words, but it's a way, you know, just to get a few more things in and let people know you a little bit better. All right?
So all right. Sure, Craig, go.
Okay. First, as I mentioned, you have a PhD from Duke. That makes you a Dukie. Will they ever win another NCAA tournament game again? They've lost, I think, in the first round the last 3 years.
Of course they will.
Put that in the affirmative. Check. Okay. You mentioned living in Massachusetts. There are lots of parts. We saw what happened in Atlanta when they got 2 inches of snow. In your book, what is a big snow?
2 feet or more.
It has to be 2 feet or more. Gotcha. Okay. Do you prefer New England or New York style clam chowder?
New England. Definitely New England.
I don't understand.
Particularly, I make it myself. You know what I do? When we're up in Maine, I actually dig the clams and steam them, and then I smoke them in this little tabletop smoker I have. You do all of that, and you have to cook some of the potatoes early and smash them down so you get like this really thick broth. And then the kicker is you've got to put just a couple ounces of the right kind of bourbon right in at the end, and that's it right there. It's as good as it gets.
Oh, Daddy, I got 2 Fridays of Lent left. I'm coming to your house for one of them, I can tell you that. Lastly, and this might be just a few more than two words, let's just say you only had 15 seconds, an elevator conversation, whatever you want to call it. What's the most important advice you could give somebody?
Don't believe what you're reading right now. Trust yourself. Do your own research. Look at what's going on because we're being fed an extraordinary amount of misinformation that's really potentially very misleading, if not damaging.
That's kind of the old liberal arts education, where ask your own questions, right?
Don't Absolutely. Don't just take trust yourself. That's the critical part.
Yep.
Got to trust yourself.
Excellent advice, Chris. I can't thank you enough. Just, you've been extraordinarily generous with your time, and the information you've shared is just so valuable. Again, everybody, please visit peakprosperity.com. Google Chris Martinson. There's videos of interviews of him and stuff that he's done that's all over the internet. Check it out. It's a tremendous resource. Chris, thank you so much for coming by Turdville. I hope we can do this again sometime soon.
Well, I do too, and thank you for the opportunity. Craig, really appreciate it, and I hope people listening got something out of this.
God bless. Hang in there and keep fighting the fight, my friend.
All right, you too.
All right, thanks, Chris.